Israel annexes more land in the West Bank.
It's the largest annexation of land in 30 years. It's almost 5 square miles. Now, Israel has long had a plan to annex the Jordan Valley as a way of sort of building a buffer between Israel and Jordan.
Plus, at least 5 killed as Dnipro is again targeted by Russian missiles.
As a result of the attack, at least 5 people were killed and 53 injured, including a 14-year-old child in the city of Dnipro.
And later, how might the U.S. election be affected by the Supreme Court decision on immunity, a deadly stampede in India, and deadly weather in the Caribbean? Today is Wednesday, July 3rd, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Thousands of Palestinians have fled their homes as Israeli forces bombarded the southern Gaza Strip on Tuesday in what could be part of a final push of Israel's intensive military operations in 9 months of war. Reuters' Emma Gell reports.
Israeli forces bombarded several areas of the southern Gaza Strip on Tuesday in what could be part of its final push in 9 months of war. It comes after Israel ordered residents of several towns and villages surrounding Khan Yunis and Rafah to evacuate the day before.
An evacuation of such a massive scale would only heighten the suffering of civilians and drive humanitarian needs even higher.
United Nations spokesman Stefan Dujarric said it was the largest evacuation order in the Strip since 1.1 million people were told to leave the north of the enclave in October, citing figures from the UN Palestinian Refugee Agency, UNRWA.
People are left with the impossible choice of having to relocate, some most likely for the second or even the third time, to areas that have barely any space or services, or stay in an area where they know the fighting will take place.
Thousands who had not heeded evacuation orders were forced to flee their homes overnight during the Israeli bombardment. Gaza's European hospital in Khan Yunis, which the emergency department director says has provided continuous daily services since the beginning of the war, was forced to evacuate. This man whose sick daughter was being treated there says it was their last resort, as many hospitals have been destroyed. Whoever gets wounded will die, he says. Israel's leaders have said they were winding down the phase of intense fighting against Hamas, the Islamist group that has governed Gaza since 2007, and would soon shift to more targeted operations. The war in Gaza began when Hamas burst into southern Israel on October 7th, killed 1,200 people and took around 250 hostages, according to Israeli tallies. The offensive launched by Israel in retaliation has killed nearly 38,000 people, according to the Gaza Health Ministry, and has left the coastal enclave in ruins.
That's Emma Gell of Reuters reporting for us. Elsewhere in Israel, police in Israel's north were put on high alert after a stabbing attack wounded 2 people in a shopping mall on Wednesday. An assailant stabbed 2 men in their 20s in the city of Carmel, where police called it a suspected terror attack and said the assailant was killed but did not disclose his identity. Meanwhile, an anti-settlement watchdog group says that Israel has approved the largest seizure of land in the occupied West Bank in more than 3 decades. For details, I'm joined by Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
So this is in the Jordan Valley, which is a large swath of land that goes between Israel and Jordan. And it's not where most of the Jewish settlements in the West Bank are. That's where you think about Ramallah, you think about Nablus. But this is about 20% of the West Bank. And the Peace Now report says it's the largest annexation of land in 30 years. It's almost 5 square miles. Now, Israel has long had a plan to annex the Jordan Valley as a way of sort of building a buffer between Israel and Jordan. And the Jordan Valley has about 65,000 Jewish settlers and 11,000 Palestinians.
It would seem that with everything going on and the international reaction to what's going on in Gaza, the Israelis taking more land from Palestinians, or what looks like taking more land from Palestinians, they might want to wait on that if they're being a little more politically aware. What's the reaction been?
Well, you know, the reaction has been that they're not taking land directly from Palestinians, that this land is what's in what's called Area C. The West Bank is divided into three parts. Area A, which is under complete Palestinian control and is about 20% of the West Bank. Area B, which is under joint Israeli and Palestinian control and is about another 22%. And Area C, which is the rest of it, almost 60%. And Israel controls Area C. Now, the hardliners in Benjamin Netanyahu's government have long advocated annexing the entire West Bank and, as a first step, annexing Area C. So they're really in Israel. There hasn't been all that much reaction. You know, they're so preoccupied with everything else that's going on, the war in Gaza, possible war with Hezbollah in Lebanon, that the move has kind of passed without a lot of Israeli reaction.
And speaking of the tension with Hezbollah in Lebanon, Israel just assassinated another Hezbollah leader. Can you tell us who that was and what happened?
Yes, he was a senior Hezbollah leader in South Lebanon. Israel used a drone to attack the car that he was in. And this has actually been ongoing for quite a while. Israel has assassinated dozens of Hezbollah leaders since the war began with Gaza, and Hezbollah joined that war basically the day after. However, given the ongoing tension between Israel and Hezbollah and the fact that this was a fairly senior leader, it could lead to more tensions between Israel and Hezbollah. The Biden administration's point man, Amos Hochstein, is meeting with the French President Emmanuel Macron today and is trying to work very hard to kind of bring both Israel and Hezbollah back from the brink of a war. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu issued a statement a little while ago saying that anyone who says that Israel is backing down on its goals to eradicate Hamas is incorrect. And most people believe that the key to a solution with Hezbollah is first a ceasefire of the war in Gaza. That before a ceasefire in Gaza, Israel won't have any kind of an agreement with Hezbollah. And as tensions keep ratcheting up, it's possible that, although it seems that neither side really wants a full-scale war, Israel, Hezbollah, or Lebanon, that it could kind of develop into that based on a miscalculation or based on, you know, a disproportionate response to an attack by one side or the other.
VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. Linda, thanks for your reporting today.
Sure. Thank you, Steve.
Shifting focus to Europe now, Russian forces have launched a missile and drone attack targeting the eastern parts of Ukraine. Meanwhile, Ukrainian officials say they are not ready to make compromises with Russia for the sake of ending the war. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has more from Kyiv.
On the morning of July 3rd, Russian forces launched a missile and drone attack on the eastern regions of Ukraine. The explosions were heard in the Zaporizhia, Kharkiv, and Dnipro regions. As a result of the attack, at least 5 people were killed and 53 injured, including a 14-year-old child in the city of Dnipro, the city's mayor reported. Meanwhile, assaults by Russian troops are increasing on the eastern front line. Institute for the Study of War report states that Russian preparations, which can be implemented in various directions soon, indicate a more advanced level of operational planning and foreseeing than the Russian command was capable of at the beginning of 2022. However, the ability to implement Russian plans will be limited by the overall low level of tactical capabilities of Russian forces currently fighting in these areas. A spokesman for the Ukrainian forces in the eastern direction said that Russian troops are beginning an assault on Chasovy Yar from the Torez direction in the south. The Russian forces attack in the direction of Torez-Chasiv Yar using mostly small infantry groups and occasional mechanized attacks. The talks about a possible peace agreement between Ukraine and Russia are ongoing. According to Politico, Donald Trump is considering an agreement under which NATO undertakes not to expand eastward, particularly into Ukraine and Georgia, and is negotiating with Putin about how much Ukrainian territory Moscow can keep. According to the head of the Office of the President of Ukraine, Andriy Yermak, Ukraine is not ready to make compromises with Russia regarding territorial concessions for the sake of ending the war. although it will listen to advice on how to achieve a just peace, he told reporters in Washington. When asked how Ukraine evaluates the statements of U.S. presidential candidate Donald Trump regarding the end of the war, Yermak replied that at the moment there is no clear answer, time will tell. According to him, Ukraine will lobby the new U.S. administration to continue to support it, adding that Ukraine has received bipartisan support in Washington, and polls show that most Americans still support Ukraine after 2 years of war. At the same time, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, after his visit to Kyiv, admitted that President Zelensky did not support his peace plan. In statements to the press after the end of the bilateral talks, Orban said that he offered Zelensky an immediate ceasefire on the current line of contact with Russian troops, which, in his opinion, would speed up the peace talks. He added that he did not insist on his initiative and accepted the Ukrainian arguments. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We'll take a look at some of the implications of the recent Supreme Court decision granting immunity to presidents in just a moment, but our coverage of Europe continues with a look ahead to the upcoming NATO summit in Washington. Katerina Lysanova is the VOA Ukrainian Service's congressional reporter. She was on Capitol Hill Tuesday finding out what lawmakers' expectations are of the upcoming NATO summit in Washington, asking about the prospects of Ukraine's membership in NATO. She spoke to Texas Representative Republican Nathaniel Moran, who said that while discussions about Ukraine joining NATO in the future are necessary, he considers the conversation to be premature.
You know, what we're really faced with right now is the need to make sure that we continue the alliance, the military alliance of NATO, to make sure that we have another 75 years that's strong. But Ukraine's got a long way to go internally before I think they really are in a position for consideration for entry into accession into NATO, because they've got a lot of internal work to do with their government to make sure the rule of law stands true, that there's an independent judiciary, that they can establish democratic institutions that will sustain them long term, and that's internally on them right now. And until they get done with that, and until we finish this conflict between Russia and Ukraine, I don't think we need to be talking about Ukraine getting into NATO. I think there needs to be discussions about way down in the future what that pathway might look like. But right now, we've got some immediate issues to deal with, and this is a premature conversation.
Lysanova also spoke with New York Representative Democrat Patrick Ryan, who said the summit will be an important moment to continue to build a coalition of democracies fighting against Putin and against authoritarian dictatorships.
Well, number one, it's just so important that we finally passed the legislation and the funding to support our allies in Ukraine. They're in an existential fight, so we have to continue to support them. The NATO summit will be a really important moment to continue to build that coalition of democracies fighting against Putin and authoritarian dictatorships. So I'm going to continue to push to do that, and I'm optimistic that the forces of democracy are going to win.
And what about Ukraine as part of NATO? Do you see any possible future steps that might bring Ukraine closer or faster? Or what are the terms for Europe?
Well, we have to continue to do everything we can to build the strongest possible NATO, to build the strongest possible deterrent to Russian aggression. And having the conversations about Ukraine being part of that are absolutely critical, given, of course, the fight for their lives that they're in right now.
NATO isn't the only international alliance making news today. Russia's President Vladimir Putin is at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit in Astana, Kazakhstan. Kylie Vaughn has more.
Russian President Vladimir Putin and Azerbaijani President Ilham Aliyev met in Astana, Kazakhstan on Wednesday on the sidelines of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit. The two leaders praised bilateral ties between the two countries, with Aliyev saying Russia and Azerbaijan have been working as allies for the past 2 years. Later in the day, Putin also met with Turkish leader Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Putin said the two are actively working on the most important issues of international politics while remaining constantly in touch. Putin is also expected to meet Chinese leader Xi Jinping and Kazakh President Kasym-Jomart Tokayev later on Wednesday. The SEO was founded in 2001 as an international group to counter Western alliances. Nigel Gold-Davies, Senior Fellow for Russia and Eurasia with the International Institute for Strategic Studies, said the group is not a security or an economic alliance. Rather, its core principle simply lies in the optics of non-Western countries gathering together. Kylie Vaughn, VOA News.
President Joe Biden is speaking out against Monday's Supreme Court decision that gives former presidents immunity from prosecution for any actions that fall within their official job duties. The High Court's ruling doesn't dismiss former President Donald Trump's 2020 election interference case, but it does delay it. VOA's Dora McQuarrie reports.
President Joe Biden slammed the Supreme Court ruling that former presidents cannot be prosecuted for any actions that fall within their official job duties. A decision related to former President Donald Trump's alleged involvement in the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol.
The American people must decide whether Donald Trump's assault on our democracy on January 6 makes him unfit for public office in the highest office in the land. The American people must decide if Trump's embrace of violence to preserve his power is acceptable.
The former president reacted to the Supreme Court decision on his website by sharing a social media post, which appeared to be from his Truth Social platform, that said, "The Supreme Court totally dismantled most of the charges against me. Joe Biden should now call off his dogs. Our country should now be focused on greatness again." The High Court did not dismiss the current election interference case against Trump. He's accused of trying to overturn the 2020 U.S. presidential election won by Biden. Chicago Kent Law professor Harold Krent says Trump's actions leading up to January 6 straddle both official and unofficial acts for which Trump could be prosecuted.
To the extent that he was acting as a private candidate, then his acts would fall into the bucket of unofficial acts. But to the extent that he was talking to the vice president about what he thought the vice president should do in the Senate, what to the extent that he was talking to the Justice Department about whether or not there was fraud in the voting, then he was acting in his official capacity.
The events of January 6th were mentioned only briefly during Thursday's presidential debate, but the insurrection could be a major campaign issue if the Biden campaign presses the issue, says George Mason University political science professor David Ramadan.
That's why I put the burden on the Biden campaign to remind that independent voter. Then it is a huge issue for them. If they're not reminded of it, day-to-day life, it's been 3 years and people start forgetting and they worry about other things.
With the American electorate so polarized on the left and the right, it is independent voters who could tip the scales on Election Day. George Mason University political science professor David Ramadan.
So independents are the only swayable. They will make or break this election. Women are on top of that swayable portion of the electorate. The young voters are also swayable. Now, they're not dependable voters.
So the election interference case against Trump likely goes forward, with a lower court making key decisions about appropriate charges in light of the Supreme Court ruling. Experts say a trial is unlikely before Election Day. Chicago Kent Law professor Harold Krent.
This absolutely delays legal proceedings. If that was a goal of President Trump's camp, then it was accomplished.
That leaves it up to the Biden campaign to decide whether to make January 6th a central campaign issue. Dora McQuarrie, VOA News, Washington.
On Wednesday, relatives were mourning their loved ones lost in a deadly stampede that killed at least 121 people in the Indian state of Uttar Pradesh. More from VOA's Steve Miller.
Family members gathered around sealed body bags a day after a religious gathering turned deadly. This man says that someone called him, telling him that his mother was no more. Thousands of people at a religious gathering in India rushed to leave a makeshift tent, setting off a stampede on Tuesday that resulted in fatalities and injured at least 80 others. It was not immediately clear what triggered the panic following an event with a Hindu guru locally known as Bahul Baba. Local news reports cited authorities who said heat and suffocation in the tent could have been a factor. Video of the aftermath showed the structure appeared to have collapsed. Sonu Kumar is a villager who provided assistance after the stampede. He shares that when he arrived, some people were breathing and others were not. People were in terrible condition. He and others poured water on them and gave them additional water to drink. He also shared there were no ambulances there. Deadly stampedes are relatively common around Indian religious festivals where large crowds gather in small areas with poor infrastructure and few safety measures. On Wednesday, India's northern Uttar Pradesh state chief Yogi Adityanath ordered a judicial inquiry. He announced the formation of a special investigative team looking into several aspects of the incident, adding a preliminary report has already been released but didn't give any details. Adityanath did say that those responsible would be punished. An earlier police report did say that thousands of devotees attending the religious event shouted and ran towards the car of the guru holding the event, which led to the crowd crushing each other as many sat in the gathering. Some people also fell into a nearby field of slush and mud and were trampled. Steve Miller, VOA News.
And finally, today is the Caribbean sees its first Category 5 hurricane of the season, killing at least 6 people. And countries including India and China experience record rainfall, flooding, and landslides. Scientists warn that extreme weather is here to stay because of climate change. VOA's Aru Pandey reports from Washington, where U.S. President Joe Biden on Tuesday announced new climate resilience measures.
After carving a path through the Southeast Caribbean, Hurricane Beryl is now barreling toward Jamaica, where fishermen like Clive Davis worked to secure their boats.
Yeah, and it developed so quick from a tropical depression, so fast. History, them say, yeah, history.
And this year's hurricane season is already making history, scientists say. Andrew Dessler is a professor of atmospheric sciences at Texas A&M University.
What's unusual here is that it's forming earlier in the year than we expected. We normally get storms like this in August and September, and yet we're getting this in June and early July.
In Washington, which has seen the hottest temperatures in nearly a decade, emergency officials on Tuesday briefed President Joe Biden and members of his cabinet on extreme weather.
Already, tens of millions of Americans are under heat warnings from record-shattering temperatures. Last month here in D.C., temperature 100 degrees. In Phoenix, Arizona, 112 degrees. In Las Vegas, 111 degrees.
Biden noted extreme heat is the number one weather-related killer in the United States and announced measures to help protect Americans, including new safety standards in the workplace and about $1 billion in funding for projects to safeguard communities against natural hazards like storms and flooding. Scenes that are already playing out across the globe in places like New Delhi, India, which is now dealing with heavy rainfall after seeing a record high temperature of nearly 53 degrees Celsius in late May. Again, climate scientist Andrew Dessler.
It is getting hotter and hotter. This is not your mind playing tricks on you. This is physics. We're dumping greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. They trap heat. And the result is a hotter globe.
Scientists say the high temperatures, rise in sea level, and changes in precipitation patterns will likely mean more storms like Hurricane Beryl. Aru Pandey, VOA News, Washington.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.